Welcome to the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. It's a podcast that amplifies the voices of people with MCS and highlights emerging research about the illness. In this episode, I'm speaking with Roselle O'Brien. Roselle is a licensed clinical mental health counselor based in Massachusetts in the United States. She's deeply dedicated to providing support for those whose lives have been impacted by multiple chemical sensitivity. She's been a medical professional for over 30 years as a licensed nurse and is an educator, psychotherapist, and creative arts therapist, as well as a musician and writer. Roselle combines all of her skills in a holistic approach to care, health, and wellness. For more information about Roselle's counseling and work, please visit her website, counseling@sella.com, or just Google Roselle O'Brien Counselor. I'm also posting a link to Roselle's website on all platforms where you get your podcasts. In our conversation, we talk about what it's like for people with MCS when we're dismissed and misdiagnosed by medical professionals. We also talk about how to ask family members, friends, housemates, and others to accommodate us. I really appreciate Roselle's compassionate approach to working with and supporting people with MCS, and her insights about how we can communicate with others, and above all, how we can put our health first. I hope you enjoy the interview. Well, Roselle, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast, and I've been really looking forward to speaking with you. You have a lot of wisdom that I think listeners are really going to benefit from. So maybe we can start with, what is it like for people with chronic illness? And I think let's talk specifically about MCS. When people in their lives don't believe them. Is that something you see a lot in your practice?
It's still very common. Sometimes the people who are closest to an individual are skeptical, flat out think they're mentally ill, don't believe it. That's not always the story, but it's very real and a part of it. And it's good that you mentioned chronic illness. And then when it's a chronic environmental illness with all the chemical sensitivities and stuff, those are two very different things. And chronic illness, the expectation is it's diabetes or a heart thing. And this is what you do. And if there's a problem, if someone's having symptoms, it's because they're not following the sugar-free diet and this doesn't fit that mold at all. And then it's a challenge because doctors, they're not trained to recognize it, to know what's going on. And they shuffle them off to therapists who aren't trained.
So I think everybody, most people, virtually all of us who have MCS experience this on some level. And in your practice, how do you see it? And what's the impact? How does that affect a person who has
the disbelief MCS? Or the lack of knowledge or all of the above?
Yeah, I think all of the above. Like, let's just say one's friends or family or partner is skeptical and even gaslighting them. What does that do to someone who's struggling with MCS?
It creates a hell situation for them. When I work with clients, my typical straight out focus is you're not wrong. You have something. It is real. And strengthening that self-belief and self-trust, because we're raised in, you know, it's part of our culture that doctors, the medical profession, they're sort of on pedestals and we just go, yes, yes. We're not really 100% there that we are consumers and that we know our bodies and that we are in living our bodies. We are experts in ourselves. And just because you can't find the right label doesn't mean that what I'm having happen to me isn't real. So we do a lot of supporting of that, and that people need to start by educating themselves about what's going on, because it's a long road of not do it yourself, because people aren't alone, but it's so individualized that you need to learn what your tolerances are, what you can eat, environments you can and can't be in, and how to just tell people nope and yes. And so believing in you becomes secondary to staying healthy. And in the end, what you focus on are the people who do believe in you, and the ones that don't, it hurts, but you can't stay in that space. So I work with clients too. Well, yes, you know, yes, it hurts, but let's focus on who does believe in you and the thing, you know, and what you're doing to feel better and stay healthy.
Yeah. And even though the statistics, the research shows that millions of people have MCS, mm-hmm. it's rare, I think, for folks to actually meet a clinician who can diagnose and is willing to diagnose with MCS. And I know for myself, it's very painful, right, to be dismissed. And so, you know, because we go to a doctor hoping for help, and when we're dismissed or misdiagnosed, what does that do to a person?
It does a lot. It makes them doubt themselves. And these are the whole array of reactions are systemic. If they're lucky enough and haven't been given a bunch of inappropriate medications, and they're already exhausted, and with brain fog and all the other the fatigue and everything else, and trouble with eating and trouble with sleeping and all of the symptoms, it just eats away at people. It really, really does. So I come into contact with people and they're at different stages of their journey with this. It's hard because it's a lot of work for each individual person to totally revamp their lives while they're living it and mourning the loss of the life that they were living in the midst of losing it. It's just horrible. Mm-hmm. So some of it is like, as a therapist, my awareness is what do they need to have physically in their environment in place to feel better, to not be in this particular state where sometimes they can't think, or sometimes mm-hmm. they've been booted out of their housing and they're living in a car mm-hmm. at best, and it's winter, and what do we do, and where do I go, and why I can't work, and nobody believes me. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy, because sometimes it's like, how much is each person, how far are they willing to go to remove the things from their environment to which they react?
Right.
It's this colossal amount of change, and throw out everything you own. Well, if you have to, can you do that? And some people aren't able to.
And we're also, because we depend on others for our well-being, right? We don't live in isolation, right? Whether it's our neighbors or our families and friends, roommates, etc., right? Mm-hmm. And so you've talked about the challenges of not being believed. And are there any practical suggestions you might have for folks when they need to be believed? They want their people in their lives to believe them. What do we do?
Sometimes it's in how you present that information. Okay. I suggest and I share with people lots of websites that you can't argue with. It's not like somebody's personal blog, but medical stuff, hospital stuff, and not just in the United States, internationally. Wherever I find that the accurate information is there, and don't worry about whether they're going to believe you or not. Keep sharing it. Just keep sharing it, and don't change what you're doing. Don't start trying to teach them. Don't stop trying to show them. People are going to be resistant to coming along with you because they get scared. What does this mean? How is it going to change? It's more than just changing your laundry soap so you can hang out with this other person, even though that's huge. But people get scared. It's like seeing someone that you care about having their whole universe rocked. What if something happens to me? So it's almost like, I don't want to look at what's happened to you, not because I don't care about you, but because I'm so scared of something happening to me that I can't manage.
That's really important to address, that there's multiple parties involved in these relationships, right? So someone with MCS has needs, but the other person too has their own stuff going on.
Yeah, right?
And you're mentioning that they can be triggered or feel fear around it.
Yes.
Right?
And not about the person with it, but about their own fear everybody has their fear about being helpless. Now, it isn't always about death, but it's just like helpless or not knowing what to do, or being completely out of loss and out of your comfort zone. And just because they hear, even if they disagree with you, they're hearing that doctors don't agree, that you don't know what's going on. And it's scary to hear about. And some people just shut you down because, shoot the messenger, because they don't want to hear the message, because it just hits their scare places too.
You mentioned that, we can share information, whether it's online, from credible good sources. And yet people point to studies that claim MCS is a mental illness. It is an anxiety disorder, for example. And they use that as a foundation for denying a loved one's illness. And we know that can be so painful, right? And so faced with that sort of skepticism and, to use the word gaslighting again, or just mm-hmm. feeling so invisible and not seen and dismissed, and often having to live in very difficult circumstances when people aren't willing to change. What can you do aside from just leaving the relationship? Because we're already so drained. Do we have to continue to ask for change? What do we do?
If the focus is on for each person to do what their number one priority is, maintaining what they need, their optimum health, whatever that may be. And it may sound kind of black and white or harsh, but it can't be otherwise. It's got to be you and your health comes first. And people are either going to want to be a part of that or they're not going to be able to, it does more harm for the person to be angry with them. It's pain and loss, but you kind of have to go, okay, well, they're not able to come here about this and not change your trajectory.
And I wonder if it's important to start the process of communicating early. I mean, I've part of a Facebook group that I'm on, I've read stories of people with teenagers, for example, and they hesitate to call it out and to ask for change. And I know even in my own situation, I had a house guest, and prior to them coming to stay with my family, I thought I was being very clear. You know, I have this MCS and we're happy to provide all your products. Please make sure you don't wear any scented. And yet they came and they continued to wear that product. And by that time, they were already in our house. It felt like too late, or I felt too uncomfortable in that moment to say something.
And it's hard to be overridden in your own house like that about your health. I'm so sorry.
And a lot of people are, right? It does. Mm-hmm. It happens in our own homes, whether it's guests, you know, we don't always live on our own. So, and even with neighbors, you know, so is it extra hard in our own homes or?
Many times it is sharing space with people. I know people who just do not let visitors come and stay in their home. They can come over, have dinner, whatever. You are not staying here. Some people can be quite rigid about, if you're going to come into my space, you do not use particular laundry soaps, do not perfume, do not use particular antiperspirants, things that they know will make them ill. And just say, and if you can't do that, that's fine. You can Zoom, FaceTime, you know, whatever. Just know I can be flexible, but not with my health, only to a point. But it's hard when you're sharing the space with other people and they are reluctant to share changes that need to be. They just need to be for a person's health.
And yet some people do report that people in lives are willing. And isn't that wonderful? Do you see that when people really are willing, whether they believe it or not?
Yes. And it's hope inspiring. It's not quite the majority of people. Hope springs eternal, but there's enough that I've noticed that there are people that like you said, even if they don't really 100% believe it, but they will respect what your health needs are. But you can't always be catering to how people need to be fed reality, because that's so draining of your energy and it's stressful, and stress makes all of these reactions worse. So some of it is really just about knowing I can't go there because I don't want to compromise my health like that.
And that takes a lot of inner strength, you know, whether it's not going to family gatherings or not going to religious gatherings, right? People can't go to the places, they can't partake in things and be involved in community. And
not in that way. It's a lot of losses. It's a lot of grief and bereavement. And a lot of deaths like that. But that doesn't also mean that there aren't ways to still somehow, and it's not the same, but it's also knowing who is supporting you, who's like totally right there. And if they're going to a church or a religious thing, it's like, hey, can you bring your iPad? Just put it on the chair. You know, we can FaceTime it so I can hear what's going on. So there's luckily devices work like that for people who can tolerate them, because not everybody can tolerate devices. And it's finding those, even if it's two people that get it, that can make all the difference, because they understand that just how you wake up in the morning is not how you're going to feel 4 hours later, And some people don't understand the difficulty of making plans, and they'll get annoyed and you'll be like, well, screw you, I'm not your friend anymore. You said we were going to get together 6 times in a row, and they don't understand. But other people are like, oh my God, you don't feel good. Don't go. We'll just do this later. So it ends up being meaning we give to things and how we internalize it. And who's driving this bus here? And we have to be, each person has to be the gatekeeper and driving their own bus. And especially in the beginning, it's a lot to get used to, but you do get used to it. And the more you can do that, the more consistently okay from reactions you can feel. That doesn't mean they're going to go away or that you feel great all the time, but there is a certain, you create almost like a safe haven in your home if you're able to. So you still have to go out and go to the supermarket, do whatever. It's still toxic, but you come home and shower. And at least in this space, it's not so bad. And as much, so it removes a lot of spontaneity out of one's life many times. But at the same time, it's not 100%. And it's like within that, sometimes it's like, okay, you woke up today and you're feeling good. Let's do something today. And people are like, cool, let's do it. But you end up continuing with the people who are willing to continue down that particular road of things. And other people, it's not that you don't care or they don't care. But they can't be the focus, and they end up just continuing to live their lives, and that's okay. And you miss them when you miss them, but you're working on how and rebuilding, because you can't go back to not being sensitive and not reacting. So some of it really is about, okay, well, I'm still here with goals and dreams. How do I morph them so I can still make them happen? So it may not be in person. Like some of my clients are performers, and it's sort of, you know, it may not be, or it can be in person. It's like, if you're really rigid for this many days leading up to it, and as long as people, you know, if you can say, hey, not try not to do these chemicals while I'm here. And if you've got, and if you can connect with doctors that do non-pharmacological stuff, who will talk about diet, who will talk about histamine, there's more and more of that. I see a lot more of that, and a more recognition of stuff coming from that end of things than from the medical profession. They're kind of begrudgingly having to pay attention, but it's all of the people, the patients, the herbalists who are just not stopping.
And I wanted to just take a step back, if we could, and, mm-hmm. and ask you, you know, how did you get into this work?
My mother, she had horrible chemical sensitivities to everything. And so I grew up with this awareness. She was a social worker, and she worked a lot in hospitals. She used to bring home masks from the hospital, the cloth ones, and but she could only use certain laundry soaps. She would react to air conditioners, to heaters. People thought she was crazy. And she just went, I don't care. This is what I have to do to feel good. And that's it. My mother was fierce like that. Just like she was just absolutely, this is how it had to be. Do not put your perfume on it. I had two sisters. So it's perfume, makeup, showers, you know, and it was just like, get out. And we knew not to do that, and not to have, if our friends came over, no perfume, no smells. I don't know what it was, but we knew certain clothing, types of clothing, you can't wear that. My mother will get sick. And this was just the rules. So it wasn't easy. But then as an adult and as a therapist and hearing this, and it's like, and I would have conversations with my mother, and it was like, wouldn't it have been a whole different world if they had been a name and a diagnosis other than she's crazy, go to a therapist. And that's what they did 60 years ago. And that's what they're still doing. And there's so much more information. And she was like, no, because I didn't listen to them. She's like, I knew what I was feeling, and I just did what I needed to do, and that was it. So she, sometimes her doctors, they'd go see a therapist, and she'd go and they'd prescribe her pills, and she's like, I'm not taking any of this. And she would never fill a prescription, but she would go to please her doctor, just as like that she was jumping through the hoops. But even then she's kind of stopped, because going to hospitals and going to doctor's offices made her feel sick. It was already kind of there my whole life. So then seeing this, it's like, oh, I get this, and I get that this is hard. And it suddenly put my mother in a whole different light, having the now medical knowledge such as it is.
Things have really advanced. There's more research, and yet it's still hard to find a clinician who does recognize and validate and diagnose. But I think one of the things that I'm hearing you say is that you saw in your mother that self-reliance that I think that you talked about, right? That's really what you, sounds like you're encouraging folks to really practice, is being that source of strength as much as you can for oneself. I just wanted to share that in the last few months, I've started wearing a mask, a half respirator, to the grocery store and even to walk the dog. And it's something they never did. I think it takes confidence in the sense to really do that.
It takes bravery.
It takes guts, right? To say, yes, people are going to judge me. They're going to look at me, but these are my needs. And it sounds like that's what you saw your mother do. And be very clear with people around, this is what I need as much as we're possible. And it's very difficult to do that, because we're met with such skepticism.
And it doesn't have to be confrontational. I have also found that, and I tell this to clients, a lot of it can be how you coach it, how you frame it. Sometimes, like, you don't have to go down the whole chemical sensitivity road. You can say, I have really bad allergies. People now understand at least a little bit about allergies. So people, they may not understand it, but they get, if you say, oh, I have severe allergies. And sometimes it's like, you know, it's like to peanuts, or someone has a bee sting and they're unconscious on the ground in 30 seconds. I'm like that, or however it is for them. Mm-hmm. And people will kind of go, oh, okay. And that's not scary. For some reason, allergies aren't scary. It's right. Isn't that weird?
I feel like it's a good thing. And my hope is that the research will progress and there'll be more and more education, so we can really call it what it is.
And I think know what it is that we're calling it, and have everybody agree. Maybe it's for my mother, but I'm very much like, this is what it is. This, and it's a medical, physiological, physical thing that's happening. It's not a mental illness. It's hard because it includes brain fog and mood. Everything is impacted. So a lot of what I'm focusing on is teaching the therapists, because that's where doctors are still shuffling patients off to, are the therapists. Right. So if the therapists know enough to do some sort of an environmental assessment for exposures, because otherwise two people presenting with the exact same symptoms, only one of them has an environmental illness. Well, okay, one person without the environmental illness may absolutely have a diagnosis of chronic depression or something.
Right.
But the person with the environmental illness should not, because it's just a reaction to being exposed to a toxic chemical.
One of the reasons it's just so fascinating to speak with you and to hear from you is because of the work that you continue to do around educating counselors and therapists. And would you be willing to speak about that part of your work and how receptive are therapists generally? I mean, even in doing this podcast, it's been challenging finding to have guests on who specialize in MCS and do therapy. How easy is it for folks to find a therapist who knows about and recognizes MCS? What are the top things you're sharing with them so that when they meet clients, they can be really supportive? What's the greatest need in your view?
It's not easy to find a therapist who is well-versed in working with clients with environmental illnesses. That being said, the biggest challenge that I have found, even like there is a psychologist who specializes in working with clients with chemical sensitivities, but it was a real struggle to get him to see just what we were just talking about before, that here are two people and teasing apart. Having an environmental illness doesn't mean that the person may not also have a mental health issue. That's fine. But teasing apart someone who's presenting like with, let's say it's anxiety, to be able to tell, is it anxiety because of the person's the normal situation, or is the anxiety reacting to a toxic chemical in their environment? And it was the hardest thing initially for him to make that separation in his clinical head. When you're talking about therapists, you're talking about myself included, people who for a living like to take things apart to see exactly what's working, what are the influences, and how to best support someone. So once he got that, and he was like floored for a minute, he was like, he sat back in his chair. He was like, oh, okay, this changes things. So I push for that aha moment, just so they, you know, so it's like, so now you need to have a tool to be able to assess what's what.
And we as folks with MCS, we understand that, right? The whole chicken and the egg thing. We understand that.
Because if you're living it.
Yeah, we know personally, right? Like I have, I think, normal levels of anxiety, right? That we all do, faced with the global and the personal issues that one faces, right? Being alive today, we all have some anxiety, right?
Sure.
But I know my anxiety spikes when I'm exposed to a toxin, as you're noticing. So why is that so difficult for whether it's a general practitioner or a therapist to really understand? Like, it's fundamental and we want to be believed.
They're following a model. They're following. When I was taking the state test for licensure as a licensed mental health counselor in Massachusetts, and I was doing the pre-test things, like the study to pass the test, and I signed up every single practice test, I failed. So I signed up with a different study online thing, and this other teacher said that regardless of what your approach is to therapy and counseling, answer the questions on the test as if you're a cognitive behavioral therapist and you will get the answers right, because that's what they're looking for. And I did that, and it wasn't what I know about cognitive behavioral therapy. You can't not know, but I am not a cognitive behavioral therapist, but I answered the questions that way and I aced all of the practice tests. So there's this model. And insurance companies use it. That's why insurance companies, you have six sessions, you have four sessions, it's all the pay for it. That's a cognitive behavioral therapy approach that does not work. It does not fit with any chronic illness. They try to make it fit, but especially these types of chronic illnesses. So there's that. So you walk, but when you get just a therapist, you're walking in, the majority of therapists are CBT, but they're walking into an inappropriate model. And the therapist is entrenched in that model. And they have to be first shown that they need to step outside of this way of thinking. And that's a little bit of a struggle initially, but once the therapists that I've talked to, they kind of one-on-one more and more, once they get it, they're like, oh, I get this now. But so sometimes they don't even realize that they're just sort of in that little box.
And so you're saying very clearly that in therapy and counseling, they're working off of a model that's So when anxiety is presented, they're painting it all with the same brush. And really what it takes is a nuanced approach. Are you optimistic that more counselors will pick up on this?
I just started a PhD program, so just to work on specifically that with its focus. So I am absolutely, yes, optimistic. We'll see what happens. But I, because it really is looking at where can change be affected in the, not the largest way, but it's like, where are the patients going? Where are the individuals being sent to? In this process of not being understood and not being heard and not being supported in any way medically, for the most part, that's the common experience. It's like, where's that target area where change can happen? Because it still is, and it's also going to be 100% driven by the patients. So that's the other piece of it, is educating the therapist, but also, so it's wonderful that you mentioned you're part of the group with so many people, because it's all a platform to share and educate each other.
On Facebook.
Yes, on Facebook, yes.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful.
It's been so interesting listening to you, and it would be wonderful to connect again, because you have so much to share. I feel like we've just kind of touched the surface, but perhaps as a last thought for listeners, would you advise folks with MCS, whether in the beginning or middle or even if they've had the condition for ages, is counseling or therapy, can it be beneficial, or are there any things
it can be it can be absolutely be beneficial sometimes to circumvent that cognitive behavioral therapy model kind of thing? It ends up then being what each person knows to look for. Strategies that absolutely help with across the boards with reactions are mindfulness ones, yoga ones, visualization, things that are that body, mind, spirit. Those are things that 100% help. And knowing that they're a consumer, that when you go to find a therapist or a counselor or somebody, you should ask them, what is your approach? Because cognitive behavioral therapy is good if you're like nervous about getting on an airplane and need to go on a trip. Cognitive behavioral therapy starts with the premise that they're working to change the client's maladaptive behavior. So that's a completely wrong premise to work with anybody with MCS or any environmental illness. It's living a life of a victim of all the things that are out of your control and other people's behaviors. So looking at what you can do with your responses, because intense emotions make things worse, whether happy or sad. I don't want to call it keeping that Zen place, but it is kind of like that within oneself. That's all about recharging your own inner battery.
Rosal, I just wanted to thank you so much for taking this time. And I really sincerely think the work that you're doing is so beneficial for folks with MCS. And I think people are really going to benefit from listening to you speak. So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast. Thank you to Rosal O'Brien for joining me. The podcast was produced by me, Aaron Goodman, Danny Penaloza, and Emma Bolzner. Please subscribe to the podcast to never miss an episode wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on social media. Just search for the Chemical Sensitivity Podcast or Podcasting MCS. Get in touch. Email me at info@chemicalsensitivitypodcast.org. I'll definitely respond. And thanks so much for listening.